Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, movie theaters are opening back up. We review Nobody, starring Bob Odenkirk, and our guest is Adam Wingard, the director of Godzilla vs. Kong.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hello, Blenders. Welcome to episode number 158 of Real Blend, a podcast that can't believe they're actually going to call the sequel Face On. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and this week's show is jam-packed with information, including information about that Face-Off sequel that's coming up, because we have Godzilla vs. Kong director Adam Wingard as our guest. We're also going to be talking about movie theaters opening soon, and we're going to be reviewing Nobody, the new film by Bob Odenkirk, doing his best, well, I don't know what it is, Death Wish? Taken?
John Wick?
John Wick? It's a John Wick type riff-off? Well, we'll get to that point. We'll get to Bob Odenkirk in a second. Because first I have to introduce birthday boy Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev.
Hello, Sean. Jacob. Gabriel. Good to see you guys.
Happy birthday to you, my friend.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys. Love you guys.
Yes, we're recording the day after Kevin's birthday. Send him love. And by we, I mean Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
Hello, handsome. How are you?
I'm doing well. So for people who might have missed it, because this is the full show for this week, we had a bonus episode that ran on Monday that you should go out of your way to go
Sean,
find.
Who was on that bonus episode?
The director of Tom Petty's documentary, Somewhere You Will Feel... We need to boost her numbers up a little bit. Go check out her interview with us right after you see Zack Snyder, the director of Justice League and Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman, as well as 300 and Watchmen, joined the Real Blend podcast. Some really great feedback from everybody on it. Seems people in the comments are truly digging it. A lot of people are sharing it. We are so thankful for you guys checking it out. We're so thankful for Zach to coming by. And I love the fact that, we were able to talk to him. We talked to him actually on the day that the Snyder Cut got released, which was really special for us. And it was really cool to have him on. So make sure you go check that out. It's over on our YouTube page. You can also download it where you get your podcast. If you're watching us on that YouTube page, as I mentioned, make sure you go down and hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. If you're listening to us on your podcast portals, go to the description to find out where to go for our YouTube channel. And of course, there's the Real Blend Premium, which we're always promoting as well, too. We drop bonus episodes of the show every Monday. You can go sign up for that at bit.ly/RealBlendPremium. Let's get to the weekly poll. I know we just have been talking about Snyder Cut for a really long time and the extension of Justice League, but we're ramping up for a movie that we're going to have some really interesting conversations about for the next couple of weeks, Godzilla vs. Kong. And I put it to our listeners, and I said, settle this fight. Who is going to win this battle, Godzilla or Kong? Jake, of all the people who voted, what direction do you think they went with the poll? Who is going to win this fight, this big screen epic extravaganza, Godzilla or Kong?
It seems like, I was trying to think about the conversation that came out once the trailer was released, and it seemed like a majority of people were leaning toward, logistically speaking, that Godzilla would win. It seemed like there was maybe a want for Kong to win.
Right.
I think that element comes from the fact that he's just a little bit more human, so I think he is more relatable in that sense. So it depends on how our audience voted, like how they thought, like, okay, like logistically speaking, like Godzilla's bigger and he's got fire breath, or if they went with their hearts. I'm going to say they chose Godzilla.
Okay, before I get to the results, you're right in that I've heard the comparison that almost ties it back to Batman vs. Superman, not to stay on Snyder, although we love Snyder, in that most people would argue, like, there's no possible way that Batman, who is a person, no matter how many gadgets he has, you know, or how many things, would be able to defeat Superman, because Superman is just all-powerful. And it, by comparison, Kong should not be able to beat Godzilla, because Godzilla is a massive creature. And not that Kong is a slouch, I'm not trying to dismiss him in any way, shape, or form, but you're right, it's people who are voting from their heart. And Godzilla did win. Godzilla got 52% of the vote, as opposed to Kong 48%. And a lot of people on social media asking, is there a clear cut winner in this movie? And we can't review it yet, so we'll hold off on that conversation. Kev, are you surprised by the results?
No, I mean, I'm surprised how close it was. I agree that I think people want Kong to win because, just, you know, emotionally, Kong is a very interesting character. But no, I think Godzilla, I think at the end of the day, if you're looking at putting them up against each other, I think people are going to probably choose Godzilla. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
I don't remember where either of you two are. Okay, taking this movie out of it, because we can't talk about it yet, where do you rank the other three MonsterVerse movies that we've gotten so far? We have two Godzilla films and Kong Skull Island.
I'm going to be honest with you. Yeah.
And then down here,
yeah,
Godzilla and King of the Monsters.
All right. But you both like Skull Island a lot.
I think Skull Island, it's great.
Skull Island's amazing.
Yeah, it's like Apocalypse Now with a giant ape in it.
I saw someone on Twitter the other day. It made me really happy. There was something about, like, this universe of films, all the directors have, like, really good beards. And then you look at, there was a photo of Jordan, the director of Kong Skull Island, this massive beard. And then, as you just saw, or you're going to see in our Adam Wingard interview, or is it Wingard or Wingard?
Wingard. Wingard.
Okay.
Whatever Sean says, it's the opposite.
Yeah, he has an epic beard too. I thought it was really funny that both those filmmakers in the, I don't know who directed Godzilla, was that
some beardless hack?
No, it was
Michael Dougherty
did the second one. He did Godzilla King of Monsters.
Gareth Evans, right? Wait, Edward, there's two of them. What was the movie
he did, that monster film with that awesome...
It's called Monsters, I believe.
Is it called Monsters?
Yes.
That's pretty funny. Got him the gig?
That's what got him, yeah.
And then, of course, Rogue One, right? He sort of directed Rogue One, from what we believe. I kind of admire Millie Bobby Brown growing out a really long beard, too, just because she's in the universe. Yeah, I mean, it's commitment to the bit. Why don't we throw it right to somebody who really knows what they're talking about in terms of Godzilla vs. Kong. We are really happy to have Adam Wingard on the show as a guest. Tremendous stories about the making of this film. Not quite spoilery. I think we avoid most of the spoiler talk. Gabe, you've listened to it, right?
Yeah, so I will say, so for our international audience, from what I gathered, you will be able to rent it starting this weekend, which is why we're dropping it now. But if you want to know nothing, then of course, you know, hold this for later. But we don't get into anything that wasn't already a part of discussions surrounding the trailers and before release. Then, of course, some face-off stuff, which is great.
Well, without further ado, Adam Wingard on the Real Blend Podcast.
Seriously, thank you for joining us, Adam. We are the Real Blend Podcast, and we're sort of a film director-based pod. We love sort of diving in and getting into the intricacies of filmmaking. And so seriously, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
So I'm going to lead us off. A few months ago, I did an interview with Bruce Campbell, and I asked him why they never moved forward on Ash versus Freddy versus Jason. And he said that in the early planning stages, that there were just so many rules and regulations about what Ash could and could not do to Freddy and Jason. Like, he couldn't hurt them too much. He couldn't do this. He couldn't do that. Like, notes from all the studios about, he was just so restricted. And I'm sort of curious, when you came into this, did you get notes about rules and restrictions about what Godzilla and Kong could and could not do to each other?
Not necessarily what they couldn't do to each other, but I will say Toho does have rules about how Kong can, or not Kong, but Godzilla can act in certain ways. Like, you know, like, I can't remember if they ever gave us like a formal list, but I was definitely said, you know, told, you know, like, you know, sometimes you're like, okay, we're going to do this. And then somebody's like, oh, Toho won't let you do that. You know,
what would be an example of that?
You know, I like, one of them, for instance, is they don't want Godzilla to emote, you know, like in terms of like, they see him as like this godlike force of nature. And so to them, it's out of character if you have him reacting in a normal way to things, right? But there was always ways around it. We definitely have some moments where I think Godzilla is more emotive in this film than he has been in any of the MonsterVerse movies. And we just had to get clever with it. And I think that sometimes that stuff is kind of presented to you in a very like, you know, like brick wall kind of way. But if you just do certain things and present it to them just right, and if they're on board with the movie, they seem to give us plenty of leeway. We never actually had them say, you can't do this. There's one shot where we actually had some blood coming out of Godzilla at one point, and
cool.
And it actually like went all over the camera. It's actually still in the movie, but it's pared down, you know, because I can't remember if that was actually directly Toho saying you can't do that, or if that was just you know, somebody from Legendary being like, we're never going to get that through Toho. I can't remember which one it was, but I do remember we did three different versions of the shot, like most blood, least blood, you know. But I was like, oh, it's cool to see Godzilla's blood. So, you know, I was just glad to do it.
So we're never going to get a scene where like Godzilla has a tear rolling down his cheek.
Well, you know, not in a conventional way, but you know, like I actually, there's a couple shots in the film to me where Godzilla is smiling and laughing, and you know, it's still interpretational, but I think people will be able to pick it out. I think I even talk about it in the audio commentary. So
yeah, in the release, the Adam cut of the film, there's going to be a moment where Godzilla breaks the fourth wall and talk fights to the audience. That's going to be amazing.
Like Cherry, but with Godzilla, you know.
I like that Adam's like, I can't have Godzilla's blood, so I'm just going to have Kong drink the blood of the dinosaur skull.
Take that. Yeah, we'll do that.
Adam, you know, I would love your films leading up to this, and you know, I've been a huge fan of you coming through the years, and I, you know, all of your films, I envision that like on the day you've completed filming, you're able to turn to your footage and process what you just saw, you know, and know whether you got the shot or not. But on a film like this, as I'm watching it play out, and the scale is just so epic, and I'm thinking like, you know, you might not see the finished product of a scene, you know, months. It'll take months for the effects to get finished. What was that like adjusting to that and just having the patience to know, like, how did you know in a movie like this that you got the shot that you needed?
Well, it's a bit nightmarish, as you're alluding to, because, you know, you, like you said, like whenever you normally have a editor's cut or and especially a director's cut, you know, which is your first kind of like 10 weeks that you have to do your first pass of the film, you always basically have the movie. You might have a couple shots here or there where you're like, okay, like, you know, we're going to add more blood to this shot because we didn't get it quite on the day or something like that. But by and large, it's the movie, you know. With this film, you know, I remember like my editor very early on, who's a really smart guy, Josh Schaefer, he worked a little bit on Kong. He worked a little bit on King of Monsters, and he's done a bunch of other movies. And, you know, he's a very smart guy because you're always playing a little bit of a game, you know, when you're working with this much money, you know, like people are looking at you and they're nervous and, you know, they don't know what you've done, really. You don't know what you've done, you know? Yeah. And he was very smart because whenever he showed me the editor's cut, we were still a long ways off from having the VFX filled in. We had certain sequences like the ocean battle. We always had previs from the start. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it fluctuated in size and stuff, but we kind of always knew what that sequence is. But there was large sections of the film that were still being kind of written as we were shooting it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for instance, like the Hollow Earth stuff, it's like, we had lots of concept art. We didn't actually know what Hollow Earth was at this point, you know what right. I mean? It was not defined yet because we didn't even have any previs on it because things kept changing. And, you know, the previs was always more focused on the Godzilla and Kong fights. And so there's lots of like these large sections of the film where you just got like text on screen saying, you know, this is going to happen here. Yeah. And that kind of things. And going back to what my editor said, he was very smart. He when he showed me the editor's cut of the film, he said, look, he's like, it's going to buy you so much with the studio if you show them a cut early, you know, because as in the Directors Guild, you have, you know, a mandatory like 10 weeks or whatever it is for your cut without any interference whatsoever, right?
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
But, you know, if you want, you can, you know, you can sneak, you know, a look to the producers, you know? Right. And so, you know, and at first I was like, go fuck yourself. There's no way that I'm going to show anybody anything early. You know, like I'm going to make myself look horrible if I do that. No way. I was like, I'm going to take all 10 weeks. And so here I am editing, you know, for 6 weeks. And I've kind of done, because what I like to do, because I, you know, customarily, I've always edited my own films. Up until recently, I started working with editors, but I still always do a pass myself. So as soon as I finish a film, I sit down for, you know, about 5 to 6 weeks by myself while the editor is doing other stuff. And I'm just doing my pass. I'm familiarizing myself with the footage and all that kind of stuff. And I'm doing totally my thing, right? And so I got 6 weeks into it. And I took a look at it and I'm just like, you know what? Like, there's so much of this film that's just not there.
Yeah.
And we've already got it down, you know, pared down to 2 hours and 15 minutes or whatever. I knew that the movie was never going to be over 2 hours. So I kind of knew what my goal was, you know? And I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. I was like, it's not like the movie's going to get drastically better, you know, in the rest of the time we have left. And we're only going to get, you know, by goodwill if we show something early. So that's what we did. We spent, you know, a couple of weeks working together. And then I think like 2 weeks early, you know, we brought in, our producers and said, okay, here secretly is where we're at. And, you know, we want to bring you guys in on the process. And, you know, it, you know, you're always having to think about things kind of like that. You know, you can't just like, you know, like this piece of paper says I get 10 weeks. So go fuck yourself. It's like, you kind of shooting yourself in your foot sometimes if you get legalistic about things, you know, you have to be realistic and you have to know that they just want to help, you know, and sometimes that can be scary, but like, you know, you're all on the same team. You're all trying to make the best movie possible. And, you know, it's trying to bring everybody together to make that happen. It, you know, the second that you start creating a rivalry between yourself and the studio, you know, that's where problems happen, you know, and, you know, yeah.
Cool. Thanks, you know, Adam, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was a really cool answer. It's cool. I love the inside elements of that. You know, one thing I find interesting is your two leading characters are CGI, but you know they look incredible in the finished product. But I wonder if, two things: one, are there actors playing Godzilla and Kong in performance capture? And then two, for the actors, the human characters, Brian Tyree Henry was saying that there was laser pointers used on set for eye lines. So could you talk about kind of how you capture what Kong and Godzilla are doing? Do you have actors doing it, and then the actor, human actors, what they're looking at specifically?
Yeah, I mean, it was a variety of different things. And, you know, to be honest with you, it's really a fascinating approach because as a director, funny enough, a lot of the times I didn't, you know, I wasn't a part of the process of the day-to-day, how do you get the animation to look this way? Like, my process was always, okay, here's the script. Okay, maybe the script's not that descriptive about the action, so we have to come up with the action. So it's me sitting with the storyboard artist, you know, trying all kinds of different things, whittling it down, then giving that over to the pre-viz or post-viz animation artists who are, you know, really trying to get the angles, you know, and the timing and stuff. And so they're working off the storyboards a bit, working off of discussions that I've had with my VFX supervisor, and then they start fleshing it out. And then we take it into editorial, we edit it into the movie. And then once we kind of start locking the picture, or at least something resembling locking the picture, because you have to get these things so far in motion before the movie's even close to being done that you just have to say, okay, this scene is done enough. Go ahead and get going on the next process. You try not to waste as much money as possible, you know, because it just takes so long. Because then the next level of process is then, you know, you get to more detailed animation. And then after that, you get into the actual emotions of the monster. So, you know, you might have like a pass that gets all the angles and all the timing right, but there's no emotion in his face. And that's where like the motion capture stuff usually would be utilized and at those levels. But I was never in the room for it. It was always through my VFX supervisor. This is what I want Godzilla to be doing. This is what I want Kong to be doing. And then you have to trust, just like you would your cinematographer or your actors, you have to trust them to bring something to you. You know, you have to trust them as artists. And And honestly, like if it was ever a situation where I wasn't, or I felt like I wasn't getting what I wanted, I would have gotten more involved in that sense. But they just always had such a great intuitive sense of how to approach the emotions of the monsters. And they could always do it through simple dialogue that I had, you know, with my VFX supervisor to them. And so that never ended up being too hard to get there. And as you know, like the movie itself has a lot of emotions in the monsters, you know, it's like, I think it's like the most emotions that you see in these monsters in this series. And so, you know, to get there, it's just such a crazy process, but it just kind of works out weirdly because you're working with talented people and you trust them and you give them the ability to do their thing, you know? And then in terms of on set, you know, like, yeah, we used laser pointers. We used sound effects sometimes, you know, like I had, we had a PA system and I would like play sound effects from E Squared, the company that does all the sound effects for the movie. And,
cool.
You know, that was something actually I kind of learned from Daugherty. I was on set for King of Monsters for a couple days, and you know, he had like a whole crazy setup, and like he had every scene it seemed like he had sound effects and stuff going on. And you know, I would use the sound effects just when I needed the actors to kind of act violently to something, but sometimes I would play music if it was an emotional scene and they're having to work with Kong and I needed a specific thing, like I'd play music. And you know, luckily Junkie XL had done some of the score.
He's a genius.
Yeah, he's great. And so, you know, he had already given me some stuff. So I was actually able to use some of his music on set to kind of just help the performances and those kind of.
Oh, he gave you score for the film already, like while you were shooting. That's awesome. Pretty rare, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always a way that I've tended to work, you know, because I like to work with the composers ahead of time and have them at least give me some sort of suites, you know, so that I can kind of at least calibrate sort of like the vibe of the movie to sort of what they're doing and vice versa. And it just gives me inspiration, really.
That's awesome.
And, you know, and Junkie XL, I mean, he's just like, he's a madman. So he's ready to jump on it and, you know, just get it done. And, you know, he works like a machine, you know.
Yeah. Great composer.
Yeah. Adam, the trailers for this film were incredible. In fact, I think they were like literally record breaking on YouTube. And there was one trailer that came out where basically if you go frame by frame, you can see a very quickly Mechagodzilla. And instantly, like, the internet just went nuts because people started going, like, taking freeze frames and people started going, oh my God, is Mechagodzilla in the film? And people started going nuts. As a filmmaker, when a trailer comes out and like a little Easter egg is hidden in there, and then the internet just goes nuts and starts like posting the image of it. Is there a part of you that's like, son of a bitch? Like that's our big moment.
No, not at all. I mean, like, as a matter of fact, with that original trailer, one of the first things that I really appreciated about it is that it is that on one hand, it felt, you know, like it was kind of giving you a straightforward idea of what the movie is, but it really didn't show very much of the film. There's so many different environments, all kinds of stuff that happens in the movie that it doesn't even allude to. But there's all these little hints that kind of play up. And I think that it was really smart because everybody knows nowadays that, you know, when you release a trailer, it's going online. That's how people are experiencing things. And people are going to pick apart frame by frame. I mean, especially on a big, you know, kind of IP property like this that has a built-in fan base, people are ready to dissect it. And with our film in particular, I mean, you know, nobody knew what this film was for years. I mean, like, you wouldn't believe the amount of, you know, Instagram DMs that I get from people like begging for the trailer, begging for anything. And, you know, it's like, you want to give it to them, but you're just like, look, it's not time yet, you know? And, you know, nobody wants it out more than me, but you know that those people are just so ready that they're gonna analyze everything and they're gonna have theories about what the movie's what's going on in that scene, and they're gonna break it down in full videos. And that was super fun for me to watch, you know, just to see all the different theories and reactions to it in general.
Adam, I promise, well, the last Mechagodzilla question, because I know it's a lot of it that we want to protect. But I'm curious from this perspective. When you come to a project like this, are you able to say to them, I ultimately want to include Mechagodzilla and use him? Or when you arrive, do they say like, okay, we're going to use Mechagodzilla, you better figure out how to make it work?
Well, I can't say anything directly about Mechagodzilla.
Sure.
But I will say that...
Let's say like, if he were to be in this movie.
Yeah, I'll be like... Hypothetically. You ever see that Ted Bundy documentary where they get Ted Bundy to talk about his murders by like talking in the third person? It's like, that's what I have to do. I have to
the one on Netflix. Ted Bundy
to talk about.
Yeah, OJ wrote a book. OJ Simpson wrote a book called If I Did It.
If I Did It. Yeah, exactly.
If I Did It.
If Mechagodzilla. Now, what existed of this film before I came on was there was a writer's room that had been put together by Terry Rossio, who's a brilliant guy. And he, so like there was like a 3 or 4 page outline, maybe it was longer, maybe it was shorter. I can't remember. And it was just sort of like a framework for what the movie could be. And so my process coming in was then sitting down with Terry for a couple sessions, and we just note carded the entire film. We like basically had 2 blackboards or 3 or whatever it was. And we went into one of the legendary boardrooms. They have really cool boardrooms with Godzilla artwork and stuff there, you know? And so you feel real fancy and stuff, you know? And by the way, like one of the first meetings I had with Terry, it was really funny. Cause you know, Terry, you know, he's been around for years. I mean, he helped write Aladdin, Shrek, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know? And so like one of the first meetings I had with him, we were in this big boardroom, just by ourselves, huge boardroom. And he's like, you know, let's just take a minute. He's like, you just have to take a moment and look at this and just know it's like, we've fooled everybody into letting us into this room right now.
We say that in every Zoom.
Yeah, we feel that basically about this job.
Yeah.
I bet, you know, so, you know, but... You know, so like we were able to go through the whole film and, you know, talk through every scene, develop every scene before he went into writing it. And we came up with a lot of really cool ideas that ended up in the movie. And, you know, so I was able to totally make it mine and, you know, put very much my own spin on it and all that kind of stuff. So that was cool.
That's awesome.
Adam, I've always found this fascinating just in cinema in general, but especially in this film in particular, anytime Kong is in distress or stressful situations, it's almost more anxiety inducing than it is to watch human characters. And I don't mean that because the human characters in this film are great, but in general, in the scope of movies, I always feel like it's harder to watch an animal in any sort of stressful, like a dog or cat, whatever it would be. And as a filmmaker, I wanted to ask your opinion on that because it's really sad when you see Kong in a situation that he doesn't want to be in, right? And there's something about that aspect that hits you harder sometimes, like with an animal creature versus a human being. And I just wonder, like, as a filmmaker, you know, your human characters are great, but I just wonder in general, like, why do you think audiences feel that way sometimes?
You know, I think that, like, you know, I think you're definitely right. You definitely feel that whenever you're watching any movie and there's an animal. I mean, that's
dog.
Why,
like,
I even feel bad just for the animals in the movie, just from a behind the scenes perspective. Like, oh, that poor dog, it has no idea it's in a movie. You know, it's told to do this stuff. I mean, I once had a scene, like I hate insects. I think they're disgusting, you know, like, and so I can't even really look at insects for very long because they gross me out. And I remember I did a pilot once and I had to, it involved a cockroach in the opening scene. And there's this like close up of a cockroach. And I remember looking at this cockroach in the close-up and I just felt like so scared for the cockroach, you know, like I was like, you know, I was like, don't hurt the cockroach. We have to be, you know, like, cause I was like, it doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
You know? And you know, and like, and kind of like, even when I was looking at the close-up, I started like imprinting even more on the cockroach. I started realizing it was kind of cute, you know?
You're right, though. I feel bad stepping on an ant sometimes. I feel guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, exactly, you know? So, you know, like, so there is this inherent thing about animals where we just feel protective to them, and the monsters are an extension of that because there's just purity to them, you know? Like, there's an innocence. You know, even to a giant monster like Kong, there's an innocence to him because he doesn't quite know what's going on all the time, you know, like he's reacting and he is this godlike entity, but at the same time, he is like a child. And, you know, like that's why like his relationship with the Gia character is so important because she's this innocent little kid. And, you know, that something about the purity between the two of them is what kind of helps their you know, mythical connection kind of grow. But yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I'm terrified for animals anytime I see them in the movie. So.
Adam, my wife doesn't watch any of these movies, but she watched this one with me last night on the screener. And I can tell you like three or four times throughout the movie when things would happen to Kong, and she'd be like, aw.
Well, yeah. You know what? Like my ex-girlfriend and I, when I was getting hired to do this film, we sat down and we watched 76 Kong, you know, and
is that the Bridges one?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen that since I was a kid. I actually really enjoyed rewatching it. I thought it held up pretty well, surprisingly. And it was a really funny thing because I never seen her emote to any movie. She wasn't even really that much of a film fan, you know, which is really kind of ironic, you know. And so after all these years of being together, like I'd never seen her like get emotional during a film, but until the ending of 76 Kong, where they're shooting Kong with the machine guns and blood is just it's very gratuitous, you know. Yeah. It's too gratuitous, honestly. And it was really interesting because I remember like I was feeling kind of emotional from it. And suddenly she goes, "Stop already, he's dead, stop shooting him." And I looked over and she had tears streaming down. Yeah. Her face. That was a big like moment for me because I was like, wow. I was like, there's something about this character that, you know, it just really pulls at your heartstrings and it just hits you to your core. And, yeah, you know, that was a big lesson for me, seeing something like that happen.
It's probably a reason why John Wick works so well, because like in the beginning of the film, when the dog dies and then he goes out and kills all these people, like you're more worried about the dog that died than all the people that he's killed.
Oh yeah.
Like,
oh yeah, crazy. Absolutely. Yeah, you can see him like headshot like a million people and it like, right?
And honestly, I like as a dog owner, like I look at that and I go, yeah, I get it. Like yeah, I probably do the same thing. Adam, I think we would be remiss if we didn't try to get some kind of face-off information from you. We're all massive face-off fans here. I think Kevin's probably about to pull one of his many copies off the shelf. So the last we heard is that it's going to be more
of a masterpiece,
a sequel rather than a remake. So yeah. I guess the obvious question, I don't know if you're willing to answer, like, are you bringing Travolta and Cage back?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to give anything away because it's still early.
It's
but,
just us talking.
Yeah. No, exactly. No one's listening. Yeah.
You know, but to me, it's like, you know, I've heard people talk about like, okay, what does he mean when he says a sequel? Like some people are saying like, okay, that he must just mean like it's a sequel in the Face-Off universe, you know, using the surgery. Maybe it's peripherals in some ways. Like to me, Face-Off is not about the surgery. It's not about the world. It's about Sean Archer and Caster Troy.
Yes!
And you know, these characters are what Face-Off is. Without them, you don't have Face-Off. And so that, to me, like, that's what the film, it's about. I won't say what that really means, but, like, that's the direction we're going in. Like, it's about the characters. You know, like, you can't, that's one thing I learned from doing the Blair Witch movie is that it didn't really connect as a sequel with people. Everybody just looked at it like a remake, even though we kind of just saw it as sort of like a fun sort of haunted house ride through the Blair Witch kind of world. Mm-hmm. We still saw it as a sequel, but because there's nothing that's really tying it into the first film, it just feels sort of like fan fiction a little bit to people, I think. You know, and I still like that movie, but like, it's like, I get why it didn't, you know, really connect.
I actually think that film is genius. I'm not a massive fan of the original Blair, but your Blair Witch, I think is like, it scared the shit out of me.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I actually rewatched it recently and I had a good time with it, you know, cause I think it does some pretty clever things.
Yeah.
And
that final act, especially.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm very proud of the movie. I'm very proud of like all the movies I've done. But at the end of the day, I know why it didn't quite connect with the audiences in the way that it should have. And so that was a lesson I learned. You know, I've learned a lot of lessons over the last few years in terms of like how to approach, you know, kind of IP material. I mean, Death Note was another one where I went in the opposite direction, where I tried to do kind of my own thing with something that pre-existed. And, you know, I think it rubbed people wrong because they it was confusing to them. It looks like, well, it's still the character names, but it's totally different, but it's supposed to be different, you know. And it's kind of, you know, like at the end of the day, you have to find a way to get to the heart of the source material. and you have to be true and you have to honor that. And it's a fine line that you're walking. And so Godzilla and Kong, I felt like was the first time that I kind of like, I nailed it. I got it right, you know? And so with all those lessons going forward, it's like, I think it really helps Simon and I know what to do when we've been writing Face Off and, you know, how to appropriately, do it.
Quick follow-up on the Face-Off thing, because it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I've seen it like 47 times. That's not even a joke. Do you consider Castor's dying at the end of the... I know that it's John Woo's movie, but I guess have you talked to John Woo? And essentially, we think Castor dies at the end of the first one. So if we were making a sequel to Sean and Castor, is that... were we to assume that Castor didn't die?
Well, isn't it weird whenever you look at the end of that film where, you know, the part where John Travolta takes the ring off of Castor Troy? You remember that part? They're in the ambulance together.
In the ambulance, yes. Well,
did you notice that Castor Troy has a bandage, that the medic has bandaged his wound? Just take another look at that scene, you know, that's all.
Oh, wow. I'm gonna put that on tonight. I just always assumed Castor died.
Just check it out, you know.
Oh my God, right. Adam, that's a great reference. I'm going to ask you another reference because we're around the same age. We grew up on the same films. I cannot watch any character pop their shoulder back in after it's been replaced and not think of Martin Riggs. Please tell me that you worked a Martin Riggs reference into Kong vs. Godzilla.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, there used to be more Lethal Weapon 2 references in the movie. Like, Skarsgård used to actually have a monologue where he talked about Lethal Weapon 2, but we cut it out of the movie. You know, if you look at the end credits, there's still a reference, like, you know, like at the very end of the credits, it kind of mentions a lot of stuff that we had to give thanks for, like, copyright reasons. And we actually have a thanks to or a credit to Lethal Weapon 2, and it's because... and I can't remember if it's still in the film or if they just had to keep it in for whatever reason, but we had like, Skarsgård's character used to drink out of a Lethal Weapon 2 mug in the movie. And we had to get the rights to leave. Actually, he used to also wear a Lethal Weapon 2 t-shirt, but it was like a Japanese Lethal Weapon 2. So you would only know what it said if you spoke Japanese or read Japanese. So
Did you cut a long sequence with Kong on a toilet with an explosive underneath him? Is that what it was?
That's for the next one. You know? No, I mean, like, you know, like, I kind of saw
Kong say, "I'm too old for this shit" at one point.
Well, you know, like, he does in his own grunty way.
That's what he's emoting.
I always saw Kong as being sort of an 80s action hero. You know, there's obviously like some John McClane references within the movie, you know, like, you know, so he is kind of like one of those guys.
That's awesome.
Well, Adam, we really appreciate your time today. It was a pleasure to have you on the Real Blend podcast. Thank you for talking filmmaking with us. We are very, very, very interested to see what you're going to do with Face Off. I'm very curious how that's going to pan out, but now I'm going to go back and watch that ambulance scene right now when I get off this call. So thank you so much for being on our show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
We want to thank Warner Brothers for hooking us up with that interview, and we want to start immediately where Adam sort of left us off, which is Face-Off conversation.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
And I love the fact that, Kev, you really carried that part of the interview by taking it the one step further and acknowledging that Caster Troy had died at the end of Face Off, because I didn't remember that necessarily. And that was a really great way to get more information out of him without him having to give up much of anything. So I don't know about you, but I went back and watched that scene immediately after we finished having a conversation with him. Did you go back and watch it too?
I mean, I've seen the movie literally 47 times. Like, I could tell you the whole scene. I could see it in my mind. I did not go back and watch it after the interview, to be honest. But I know it well enough to know where the bandages are, to what he looks like as he's sitting as Archer is sitting in the ambulance at the end as Caster. But yes,
I forgot that they okay. So remind me then when this happens, because the clip that I watched had Nicolas Cage talking, but he was talking with John Travolta's voice.
Right. So, okay, all right, you're talking about the ambulance scene specifically.
Yes. Yeah. But so when he's talking to Joan Allen, his wife, it's Nicolas Cage, and she calls him Archer, or she calls him Sean, and he's talking, and he has John Travolta's voice.
Right, because he's still... So at that point, if I remember correctly, at that point... So, yes. So Nick Cage, the actor who's physically on screen, in the body is actually Sean Archer, John Travolta's character, and the voice is coming back.
Okay, that's what it is.
So basically, if you go back earlier in the film when they were first switching faces, Travolta goes through that whole sequence where he does, like, he like massages his throat and gets his voice ready to sound like Caster. And he's like, I could eat a peach for hours. And it's like, it's like scraggly, whatever. And then it turns into Caster's voice. So if you're referring to his voice sounding like Travolta within Caster's body, that's just because his voice is coming back.
Okay.
Or somehow, I don't remember the exact details
of why. That they used. Yeah. I like that back when that happened, though, we were just okay with it. We were like, oh yeah, that works.
Yeah.
You can just massage his throat. So the bandage that I think Adam's discussing is when they put the two bodies side by side, and when Nicolas Cage reaches over to John Travolta's hand, take the ring off, Travolta's body has a very large bandage on the side that is there, I guess, deliberately, or at least these guys saw it and said, like, okay, that could mean that that the medic got to him in time.
Right. Well, also the reason why he's all bandaged up is because, remember, like, he's basically going to go back into his... Or wait, I'm trying to remember how this is going to work. So in Archer's body has Caster's face.
Yes.
So that, are they then going to...
I'm more remold? Confused than when we started.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to do that. That's going to be interesting.
They jump forward because then the next time you see Archer, he looks like John Travolta again.
Right. And that was a reshoot, that whole scene.
Which I find very funny, because apparently he's going through this really extensive surgery to get turned back into Sean Archer. And when he comes home, his wife is like at the table working on bills. Like, she wouldn't be at the hospital, like, waiting for him to come out of this massive surgery. I can imagine Michelle like getting massive surgery, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm just going to wait home for her to come back. And he comes walking through the door with like flowers and kind of thing.
Well, she better be glad she didn't have massive surgery on the day that Snyder Cut came out, because you'd be like, Michelle, it's Snyder Cut day. I'll get back to you.
I would have been pretty busy. I probably would have gone to go see her. All right. So anyway, Face Off news.
The word probably was in that sentence.
I'm sorry, Gabe.
You might have been about to ask this. My question, he was very vague and deliberately vague about what all of that meant, his hints meant. But do you guys feel, even though maybe things aren't confirmed on the business end of it, that we are going to get the original cast back?
The fact that he's emphasizing that it's a sequel and not a reboot or a remake, to me, implies that they have to be bringing them back. Because how can it be a sequel that anyone would want to make unless you're going to get the... Otherwise, have fun with it and pick two other guys that it would be fun to see them play each other.
One of the things that he said to us is that, you know, it's too early to talk about any of this, really. And what he then said in another interview the same day he was doing this is that those two guys have final script approval. Like, whatever they finish writing, those two have to sign off on.
Which means that they're going to read it. And why wouldn't they read it?
Yeah.
Unless they were involved.
It sounds like, it sounds like they're interested.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're going to commit until these guys come back with whatever their script
is. Oh, what are the two of them doing that's so much better than Face On?
Yeah, but I mean, like, that is one of the movies that both of them probably don't want to mess with, right? Like, it's a legacy title. Yeah, it's a legacy title. You don't want to just come back for a...
But to Jake's point, like... when you look at the movies that the two of them are doing now, why would they not want to redo a Face-Off movie?
Yeah. Like, and honestly, like, if Jim Carrey's given us Dumb and Dumber 2 and Eddie Murphy has given us Coming to America, like it seems like actors aren't really worried about their legacy films these days.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, we'll take that.
And potentially, like, we could be getting Ace Ventura 3, I'm hearing.
Oh, yeah. I saw that.
They're calling it Trace Ventura.
That's actually a great idea.
That was actually really good. Wow, that
was well really done.
Good. Thank you.
All right, let's get into the WB's deal to strike a 45-day window from theatrical release to HBO Max starting next year. This is going to be in 2022. This is the resolution to the fact that this year, in order to get things stimulated, that films are going to HBO Max and theaters day and date. Now it sounds like the window is going to go back to 45 days. This is coming on news. Then we'll sort of pair it into the other one. Regal Cinemas is going to reopen and they're aiming Kong versus Godzilla as their big return to theaters. And then with Mortal Kombat right behind it. All of this news has me feeling that we are close to things getting back to normal. But I'll say the Venom 2, and we weren't planning on talking about Venom, but like Venom moving out of June and back to September seemed a little hasty because they still have Black Widow and Fast 9 ahead of it. So I wasn't quite sure why they jumped, but where you guys stand, Kev, where do you stand on how you feel about us getting back to summer blockbusters amidst news that Regal is opening up in most places?
I still think that I don't want to jinx anything, but we're going in a more positive direction towards reopening certain things across the country. I truly believe that at some point this year, once vaccinations are more rolled out than they are now, that I think HBO Max, you think they're going to reverse that decision?
For the rest of the movies?
Yeah, like Dune and Matrix 4. And like, well, do you think they'll say, all right, you know what? Theaters seem to be in a good spot again. Mm-hmm. Why don't we jump back to this 45-day window? I guess the question is, legally speaking, if people signed up for HBO Max, how do you then justify that? I feel like by the time we get to hopefully the end of the year, you would think that a film like Dune, but I guess at the same time they're opening in theaters and HBO Max, so you have the choice.
You do,
but I just don't know. I don't know. Do you think they'll reverse it?
I don't see them reversing it. Whereas I see someone like Denis looking at the calendar and saying, oh, in 2022 I can go full theatrical and get a 45-day window, push my release date back. You know, I'm not gonna
hold. Does he have the pull to do that?
He might. I think he might versus some others. You don't think, Jake? No?
No.
Okay, but what if he's getting the option for people to go to theaters though, so isn't that just as good?
I mean, that's the thing too. I think HBO's argument will be, look, like, yes, people have the option to watch it at home, but those are probably people that wouldn't have gone out to see it anyway. Mm-hmm. More theaters, it's not like it's getting the Wonder Woman 84 treatment where it's only open in a handful of theaters. Like, hopefully by October, a majority of theaters around the country will be open, and people who want to and always intended on seeing it in theaters will do exactly that. You know, I often use my parents as like the average American and how they feel, and they go to the movies maybe once a year. Mm-hmm. For like they're loving this HBO Max deal because they're getting to see a lot of movies at home that they would have waited until they were streaming at home anyway to see. They, you know, with Dune, like, they probably were not going to go to the theaters to see it. So it's not like they're taking money out of Warner Brothers' pocket. It, like, they're just watching a movie that they wouldn't have gone to the movies to see anyway.
Sure. Yeah, to a lot of people, the theatrical component is not as important.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a microcosm of an example, but I think Tom and Jerry opening to $14 million the other weekend is really interesting. At a time where there weren't that many theaters open, and it was a kids' movie available for kids to watch at home, it had one of the biggest openings of the pandemic. And I think that I think Godzilla versus Kong is going to be very telling, and I think Mortal Kombat's going to be very telling.
I think Godzilla versus Kong, people will go. Yeah,
I agree with you 100%.
I have seen it, and I'm going to go out of my way to see it on a big screen because I honestly feel it warrants a big screen. That's all I can say. I can't review it right now. But.
Do you guys think they'd also be less likely to reverse just because it looks like this year is still going to have a bit of a congestion problem with releases as they're getting backed up into the tail end of the year? And like, we don't even know necessarily when a full capacity opening is going to be a thing.
Sure.
So I could see that also being like, we might as well keep the goodwill of HBO Max and not try to cram more people into fewer screens.
But I also agree with Kevin. Is that a little kind of shady on their part to promote? You know, they used a handful of movies to promote the idea of day and date releases for HBO Max and theatrical. And one of the big ones that they used and their big, hey, sign up for HBO Max thing was Dune.
I don't think they reverse it. Yeah, I think it's
I think the big movies that they claimed were going to be a part of that are going to be a part of that.
I think this announcement means that they got to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I think
they get the HBO Max release this year, and then all of us who care about that are like, okay, next year we'll go back to quote unquote normal.
So Batman will have the 45-day theatrical window before going. Right. But the fact that isn't that crazy? Like, Batman's only going to be out in theaters for 45 days before we can stream it at home.
That makes sense, though. Window,
I think that's fair. We've talked about that. I think that's very fair.
The window before the pandemic felt archaic. It was 90. Longer than it needed to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 45 days, if you haven't seen a movie in 45 days, you're not going to go to the theater to see it.
Yeah.
And if we're at a point...
I don't think Batman would leave theaters in 45 days. Sure. I just think it would just have the additional HBO Max component.
Yeah.
I think, and I feel like I've said this all along, like shorter windows are what we're going to have to agree to. There's going to have to be shorter windows. So if theaters and studios can come to an agreement that we can have a 45 or even 30 day, I even think 30 would be fair. And this is coming from somebody who's a major theater advocate. But that's why I always appreciated Netflix. And you got 2 weeks before the drop on Netflix for a major release. They'd put it in theaters to force the theatrical viewing. So in this particular instance, 30 to 45, as long as there is a specific theatrical window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all I care about. Like, every movie should be given the opportunity to play in theaters first.
Maybe effect of this. If the industry as a whole goes to like a 45-day window, if every studio does that, does that mean that the Avatar Avengers Endgame all-time box office is kind of stuck?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because, like, how long did it take Avengers Endgame to break the record? Really, they were doing it for months, right?
It was, it was at least 2 months, if not even longer than that. So you're saying, like, nothing can really challenge it?
So to the rest of time, we're just going to be reporting on an Avatar and or Endgame release that's going to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Well, but I was going to bring this up, too, because we're contractually obligated to bring up Nolan every episode.
Yes.
The idea that Tenet is going back to IMAX theaters is pretty intriguing, because maybe without the glut of titles that are fighting for screen space, you have the ability to take advantage of like IMAX technology or films that really warrant the big screen and bring them back. So that like really diehard fans, you know, that want to see Tenet on an IMAX screen, all of a sudden it's there. It used to be like you went to theaters, then you went to home video, and then everyone forgot about you. But if they now bring back these titles that really, like, say a lot of people go see Matrix 4, you know, and it's in 45 day window, it's back, it's available to stream, but everyone loves it, they're over the top for it, and then we get around to January and it's quiet, you know, and the IMAX screens are like, let's put Matrix 4 back up there, you know, and see if people come do it. So maybe the rules are changing and stretching and bending in a way that it'll be a wild new industry. I don't know. I think we should just stay flexible, keep our minds open to what they can do, and just get people back in theaters. So opening Regal Cinemas is a big deal. April 2nd, it's going to open in the U.S., May in the UK, and again, that feels like we're turning the corner and getting ready for some exciting movies to be coming to theaters.
But also, too, not just that, it feels like we're turning a corner less apprehensively than we did last time. Because remember, like, we had this conversation like around Tenet time last year, where like theaters, I did live shots with like, theaters are back, guys, they're open, and look, Tenet's about to come out, and we're doing this, and even that was sort of like, you know, in the distance, we're like, yeah, but fall's coming around, and we're talking about COVID ramping back up in the fall. This corner feels much more optimistic, much more light at the end of the tunnel, because the, we're turning the corner as vaccines are becoming much more accessible. People are open to the idea of safely going out and doing stuff, and it just feels better.
On a smaller note, but I think equally exciting for a lot of people that listen to the show, Alamo Drafthouse just announced that they're going to be opening a new location in Texas. So just exciting from the standpoint of what the investors, what people who are spending money on the industry are looking forward and seeing. And something someone like Alamo Drafthouse that just filed for bankruptcy and all that stuff is still optimistic, opening a new location in a town, a second location in the same town. So,
and also just inside baseball, like Sean, you mentioned, like you got to see Godzilla versus Kong at a press screening on the big screen. I'm seeing Mortal Kombat in a few days on the big screen. Like the fact that like press screenings are coming back, and they're still providing the option. By no means are they saying you have to do it this way, but they're doing a very cool thing where they say like, look, if you feel safe, here's a screening. Like, you know, granted, it's also very select movies. They offered us, like, Nobody on the big screen. They offered us Godzilla versus Kong. They offered us Mortal Kombat. But then they also say, hey, you know what? If you're not there yet, cool. We'll give you a code. Watch it at home.
Sure.
But that also feels very, like, turning a corner and we're there.
You know what I can't wait for? A junket we all fly to. And I know this is so inside baseball, but, like, I am so hungry for it.
Like, those interviews are going to be the best interviews ever. It's just going to be 4 minutes of us and the talent going, how are you?
You know what Sean will say when he gets to meet you guys at the airport?
What?
We fly now.
We do fly now.
I'm going to be, like, holding Vin Diesel's hand as I sit across from him. This is family, isn't it, Vin? All right. Before we started the show, we were discussing Ann Sarnoff's comments. Ann Sarnoff is the Warner Media CEO. She had an interview ready to drop on Monday.
No joke.
Not even giving Zack Snyder a full week to celebrate the return of his release of Snyder Cut, a film that, by all standards, now we don't have numbers, and we may never have numbers, but that film, I think it's safe to say, dominated the conversation in a way that the fans kind of thought that they would have to do in order to make their case that he should continue to tell more movies in this realm, and that they should quote unquote restore the Snyderverse. And Warner Media came out really quickly to say, congratulations, Zach, on completing your trilogy. And we'll be moving on from here.
Which even though every interview he has said that this is movie 3 of 5.
Yes. And in fact, went so far as to like share details about where this was going to go.
Where did he share those details, Sean?
Well, on the Real Blend podcast, for starters, you should
where
go
is
watch
that available?
30-minute interview on everywhere you can get podcast thingamabobs sold. No, downloaded. Or you can watch us talk to Zach on YouTube. Kev, how shocked are you that Warner Brothers seems to be turning their back on a universe that I think a lot of fans want to see continue?
Well, it's sad, but one of the things I find interesting about this whole situation, and Snyder said this a lot in his interviews, is like, this movie wasn't even supposed to come out. You know what I mean? So like this version, this cut that we saw, Justice League, that came out on HBO Max. And like at the end of the day, it's hard for fans because that was a massive, massive success to get that film released in its true visionary format from Snyder.
Yeah.
But of course, we're going to watch that and want more. I mean, it's just at the end of the day, that's just the nature where human beings were going to want to see what he was going to continue. Am I surprised? No. Just based on how everything went down and the whole situation. At the end of the day, I'm more surprised that the cut got released. And I mean that in a good way, because it was awesome that the fans rose up and raised a bunch of money as well and for a good cause and really did everything. That the whole story behind the Snyder Cut release is just truly incredible. So am I surprised? No, because I think that at the end of the day, the behind the scenes on this story is just, there was a lot of things that went down. There's probably things that we don't even know went down. And so I think I will say this, leading up into the weekend, I was feeling a little more confident about the fact that maybe he might be able to finish these two films. It seemed like there was a great buzz around it. They could build momentum. They could make money off of this. But then Snyder told us, obviously, that the 2017 film is canon. His film's not. So it's almost as if, I don't know, I'm saddened that we're not going to be able to continue with his version. Does that mean it's definitively not going to happen? I don't think so. I mean, this could... I think they're going to find a way somehow. I don't know how they're going to do it, but I don't know. We'll see.
I've been saying to the Snyder Cut kids this whole time to not lose focus of the fact that this movie you fought for is it's the prize. Like, that's crossing the finish line. And don't, if it doesn't get to continue, don't let it diminish from the fact that you fought for this version that they were never going to release. Like, I get that it stings to hear right now, immediately after the fact, that they don't have any plans of moving forward, but they never had plans of moving forward. You know, right. Like they had to concede to show you this version. They didn't want right. to. And Zach said on our podcast, like, they wanted to release it just as is, like right. whatever's on your laptop in that version, we'll just put that out. We don't want to sink any money into this. And so I know that it's tough to hear. But I don't think it was ever their intention to continue. And yeah. as much as I admire the campaign to release the Snyder Cut, I think it was much easier for the studio to release a cut that was 80 to 90% finished already.
Yeah. I have a question yeah. for you guys. If that's the case, and Warner Brothers never intended to and will never proceed past where the final frame of the Snyder Cut ends,
yeah.
do you wish he had not ended the film with as many cliffhangers as he did? Do you wish that he had said, he sort of cut his losses and said, well, this isn't 3 of 5, this is 3 of 3, and just ended the story?
But the movie was always set up as an opener to the other two.
But he made adjustments to the film anyway. And so sure. Do you feel like if he genuinely believed that this is it, this is all it's going to be, do you genuinely believe that he should have just maybe trimmed off that little Return of the King epilogue? No? You're okay with the open-ended questions?
I am quite the opposite. No. I actually really
I'm not
do.
Saying that I feel that way. I'm just sort of curious as to, you know,
I genuinely love that the version that exists is really him saying, this is my uncompromised part 3 of whatever would have been 5 pieces. And, you know, from here on out, he knows it's going to speculate. It's going to create speculation and conversation in his fan base of all the cool places that he could have gone. So I kind of do love that. And, you know, I don't think that we're out of the realm of possibility of him being able to continue it in some other format, like whether it's graphic novel or whether it's an animated feature or something. I just don't think Warner Media is ever going to give him the opportunity to do it live action.
So at the end of the day, the actual issue here is that Warner Media owns the rights to the characters, yes. and they have to give him permission to do it, basically.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's the when it comes down to the legal reason why he wouldn't be able to continue, it's just that simple. It's just them mm-hmm. not giving him it's not like Warner Brothers is going to sell their DC rights to a studio that Zack Snyder is not going to work with. You know what I mean? So it's like
right.
it's one
right.
of those situations where. I don't know. Going into the weekend, I genuinely felt a buzz surrounding mm-hmm. this, a positivity surrounding it that I was like, man, he's going to get to make those next two movies. Like I kept thinking he's putting all this out there so the fans can say we want this.
Yep.
And you just assume that it would. And then that interview drops on Monday and it's like, whoa, it's like, it was almost as if, like you said, like there was no plan to move forward. We got what we got. At the end of the day, it's one of those weird things where, yes, I'm just so thankful we got what we got. And now we just have to accept the fact that they, at the moment, don't want to move forward. And as a fan, it's not fun, but I'm happy that we were able to get that cut, thankfully. The fact that we got it is just, you have to understand, that movie is out. It came
it exists.
Out. Like it really... happened. And I think what makes me sad, and I get it, because that news on Monday, to have that news right after the weekend is kind of a blow, but at the end of the day, the fact that it was even released to begin with blows my mind. Like we are a very want what we want and then move on society. Like, we get what we want and then we move on from it and we want the next thing, the next big mm-hmm. thing, the next big thing. Because we're, you know, as a society, I feel like we've gotten more and more used to getting what we want in terms of movies and fan service and things like that. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to step back from it, I think, and just say, I'm thankful we got that cut. That's where I'm trying to trying to find a middle yeah. ground, because as mm-hmm. much as I want to see him continue, and as much as I think it's ridiculous that they won't let him continue, considering the fan base that's surrounding this film and the number of people who watched the film and talked about it and trended it on social media, I think we have to take a step back and go, we got that cut.
It's like begging someone to go on a date with you, and they finally yeah. concede and say, yes, I'll go on a date. And when the date's over, they say, look, like, had a great time, but like, I'm just not feeling it.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do it. Like, okay. Like yeah. I appreciate you going out with me. Appreciate you giving me mm-hmm. a shot, but like, we're not going to get married. Like, you got, but
I don't even know if the word allowed is the right word, but the fact that they even allowed it conceded. To happen, is just astounding to me. And they gave him $70 million. Yeah. Right,
and there's good time for them to say we're not going to keep going. If they say it on Monday morning, it's why couldn't you let us enjoy the fact that you know we got this? If they waited 2 weeks, the fan base would say, why didn't you tell us right away? How come you let us keep our hopes up for 2 weeks? Like, it's a lose-lose situation for everybody. Nobody wants to hear this news.
Okay,
you know?
I will say, it does feel like no matter what happened over the weekend, whether a billion people
they
watched
already decided.
It, I agree with you in that, like, that statement seemed ready to go,
Sorry, in hindsight, though, shouldn't we kind of that have been the expectation given the fact that they have a new Batman? They have a Batman TV series that's set in 100%. The new Batman's world.
Mm-hmm.
They
but have like, a Flash movie. But we're going to get another Flash movie. We're going to get another Aquaman movie. We're going to get another
But this movie isn't DCEU, though. Those movies are.
Oh, that's so stupid.
Which is really weird. So, all right, so hold on. What is technically DCEU at this moment? So
everything
Man
but
of Steel,
this, really.
BVS, Suicide Squad, Wonder Woman 1 and 2... Flash will be DCEU. Like,
that's the hill they want to die on?
Yeah.
I mean, we got Man of Steel.
Because in their mind, the universe has moved on from Zack's 2017 movie.
Right. But then why not let... So I saw this on Twitter. Why not let Snyder just continue his out of DCU universe?
Well, because they have
like, audiences are smart enough to know the difference. Like, if we're smart enough to exist in a world where we can have... Michael Keaton and Ben Affleck and Robert Pattinson be Batman all at the same time. Like, we understand. Like, we get different, like, directions. Like, it doesn't all have to be one narrative anymore.
I get it. I mean, these movies cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's almost like, okay, all right, so would Snyder...
You're talking $200 million. $200 million.
That's minimum before you even promote it. You're talking $500 million to get
it
into theaters and get people aware that it exists.
Justice League is a monster.
Yeah, but I give them $13 a month, Gabe.
True.
Well, no, I mean, and that's the thing you have to also understand is that by the time a Justice League 2 or 3 came out, we hopefully won't be in a situation where HBO Max is the only place releasing it. You would hope that it would be a global, because I mean I want to shout out HBO Max for releasing this thing, because that's a really big deal. But at the end of the day, by the time a second or third Justice League came out, you would need a theatrical component to justify the hundreds of millions of dollars you're spending, because like you said, his cut was already basically done. He just needed the other $70 million or whatever it was to shoot that last scene, finish the visual effects, make Steppenwolf awesome. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, I'd love to get into that at some point about how great of a villain he was in this cut of the film. But anyways, it just doesn't seem financially possible unless Warner Brothers is like, we will let you continue. Now, is there any way? I know we have to move on. Is there any possible way Warner Brothers could ever say, oh, you know what? All right, your movie is now canon. Joss's is not. Let's continue. Can you reverse that, or is it done?
Sure. No.
You can reverse canon decisions.
I think anything can be done. It just feels like the executives who are in charge at the moment are not into Zack's vision.
Is Batman this year or next year?
Next year.
If Batman comes out and everyone hates it, then maybe they're like, listen, Zack.
We're not going to hate it. You know it's going to
be. No, it looks great. It looks awesome.
It looks phenomenal.
But, well, Matt Reeves took a page out of Snyder's book. It's dark. It's grim. It looks like
a Fincher movie.
Snyder Fincher movie. Yeah. I'm sad, But at the, you have to remember, think about where you were a year ago when this movie wasn't even a possibility of being released. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now we're sitting here and it's out. Just focus on that positive energy, I think.
Normally, news like this breaks right after we've finished recording. But I'm pleased to announce that we have some breaking massive news. And I see some stuff down below, but you guys have been tracking the tweets while we've been talking. Apparently, Black Widow is moving back. It is now going to be opening July 9th instead of May, whatever, 7th, I want to say. It was first weekend in May. It is going to be available in theaters, but also on Disney Plus Premiere, which means it's going to be that $30 rental. In addition to Black Widow moving back, did you guys say Shang-Chi moved back also? September?
Shang-Chi moved up. Wait, when was Shang-Chi supposed to come out?
July.
Oh, then yeah, but it moved back.
Okay, so Black Widow moved to July 9th. Yeah. Shang-Chi moved to September. Did Eternals move?
The big news I saw, because basically Disney just blew up their entire schedule, which is the news that we're getting. Luca, the new Pixar film, is going to be a Disney Plus exclusive. It's not going to theaters.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's like Soul. How come Pixar's becoming the redheaded stepchild? Why are they getting theatrical?
Because there's not a number two after it.
Why would they not give Luca at least a theatrical run in simultaneous?
Cruella is also getting the theaters and Disney Plus treatment.
Oh, it's getting both. No kidding.
Yeah. Just like Black Widow.
That's just on Emma Stone alone. It's just the fact that she's in that movie.
But it feels weird that like they would do that for Cruella and they do it for Black Widow, but Luca, they're not doing it for.
Soul didn't get a theatrical release either, did it?
No, it did not.
That's crazy.
Just Disney
the family
Plus.
Movies, though, I think have proven in the last year to be a
successful
great
on their own.
But yeah. Raya is theaters and home. Raya got theaters.
Great. Well, maybe they saw those numbers, whatever they were, and they said not.
But it's going to be a different world by the time Luca comes out.
But I mean, you got to make that decision now, right?
Is Luca based on the director of Call Me by Your Name?
I don't know. That Luca. Looks very similar to that. It looks very similar to that.
The director's name of Call Me by Your Name is Luca. I was just making a
Juan
joke.
Arena. I was going to go with the Dallas Mavericks joke, but you guys don't watch NBA, unfortunately. Yeah. Wait, did Spider-Man get moved?
They canceled it. It's never coming out.
Well, that's Sony, right?
Yes, it is, but it's tied into the Marvel tapestry, so I'm just worried about them moving Spider-Man back. I don't want
but that's Sony, right?
Will you guys... Yes, it's Sony. You guys will go to theaters. I was going to ask, would you pay money to see Black Widow on Disney Premiere?
I would go to... At this point, you could project a phone book onto the big screen and I'd pay to go see it.
All right, that's big news. Black Widow moving back.
And you guys know how little I care
about... So Black Widow gets a simultaneous premium and then theatrical.
And theaters. But July. Now they're saying July. Yeah.
But Cruella is going to be end of May, they're still saying.
Oh, it is? Okay. Yeah.
How do we measure box office for a movie like Black Widow?
I don't know. Gabe brings up a really interesting point, which is like, is our measurement of because also, you know, and we've talked extensively about how I distrust the numbers that we get from streaming services. Are we about to enter into a world where we really don't know how well a movie does anymore?
Yeah, maybe.
How did Snyder's movie do?
No one knows.
I honestly don't know if we're ever going to know, because I think that if HBO Max comes out and says, oh, it was a massive success, then the narrative is going to be, well, then why don't you move forward with the Snyderverse? And no company is ever going to come out and say that thing we did was an absolute failure. So I don't think we're ever going to know what, because also too, you know, after Marvel, because you remember when, what was it? It was Wonder Woman came out, and then Marvel also had something, and
Soul.
It was like around Soul, and they were
Both
like
Christmas
almost competing
Day.
As to like which one had the bigger numbers, and they both released their numbers within a very short amount of time with each other. Falcon and Winter Soldier just came out and said it was the biggest streaming premiere in Disney Plus history, and then
Disney
Crickets.
Plus history,
and all puts in the top like
storied.
Yeah,
still
you
makes
know what
for
it
a
is?
Good headline.
You guys remember when Steamboat Willie premiered on Disney Plus?
The success of a streaming service, I think, boils down to subscriptions more than it does like how many subscribers are you bringing on board for it?
Yeah,
because that's where they're making.
Well,
their
that's
money.
The whole game. Yeah.
You also can't get the metrics on a streaming thing, because what if somebody plays Snyder Cut for half an hour and then bails out on it? It's a 4-hour film.
That's always been my. That's always
that
you know,
success.
Well, Netflix. has gone on record saying that they count it as 2 minutes. If you watch it for 2 minutes, that's a viewership.
So what do those numbers mean? Those numbers don't mean anything. And
I say that they mean nothing. They're arbitrary. But and to me, it's different than when people say, oh, like you could pay to see a movie and walk out after 2 minutes. But what's the likelihood of that? The likelihood of someone paying $15 to go see a movie and walking out is far less than someone bailing out after 2 minutes of realizing that they don't like a movie.
Yeah. So theoretically, in a world of box office, theoretically speaking, from Disney's perspective, theoretically, what you could do is you put the $30 that goes to the premium access as box office. So yes. I think that's how it would work. I mean, this is my guess. So the movie opens in theaters. You get your numbers there. Let's say it does 50 million in its first weekend, and then let's say the streaming service puts up another 30 or 40 million. There's an $80-90 million weekend. I don't see why that would not make sense. I feel like it makes sense.
If but it's
I mean,
that the kind problem of is
less people. The only issue with that is that when you pay the $30, 10 people in your house can watch it. You know what I mean? And so you're not getting the individual ticket price. But I think
that only works with a premier access. Yeah. If it's HBO Max day and date, it's just part of your subscription. There's no numbers. I've said this before. I do want to point out, I think because for us, we love talking about the numbers and that's the news and that's the narrative we build around films are box office numbers. But filmmakers have said time and time again that they love making movies for Netflix because they don't have to wait and pull their hair out opening weekend, quote unquote, and see if it's a success or not the first day it's out because it got this number versus that number. Did great. And they are like, okay, cool. Netflix is happy. I don't have to stress about that as a filmmaker. And if a filmmaker's happy, I'm hard pressed not to support that.
There's going to be a number attached to it. Like someone somewhere. Like we work in news. We might not broadcast to our viewers what our ratings are every day. Like it might not be a thing where honestly, I don't even really know what our ratings are. I don't wake up every morning and stress about what the ratings are the day before. But I guarantee you, there's someone at my station that knows what they are, and they are altering future decisions based on things. So like you can't super say that like someone the narrative's not there and that decisions aren't being made based on the numerical success of these things because it might not be as public. But someone somewhere around a board table, is making a decision based on numbers.
Netflix's kind of stated model is that they just need subscribers who are there to feel like their subscription is still valuable and enough interest so that people who aren't subscribed, which is almost, I mean, they've almost capped what they're going to be able to get, essentially, will come on board. It doesn't really matter what it is or why it is. They just need enough buzz around their product so the people hit subscribe. So it's it's hard to tie that to a single title, I think, in general.
I guess when they spend $200-something million, whatever the budget was, on Six Underground, are they making money on that?
I don't think they've made money ever.
Yeah, you know what I mean, though?
Like, I think they're still working on debt, to be honest.
Whatever the budget was for that movie, I know it did well, I guess, from the numbers that we saw, but did it do well, like in the sense of like, did they make money on that movie? Like, and The Gray Man, the Russo Brothers' brand new movie with Chris Evans and Ryan Gosling and Regé-Jean Page from Bridgerton, that's apparently the most expensive movie Netflix has ever made.
No kidding.
How are they going to gauge how successful it is?
Yeah, I don't know, because there's so many ancillary sides that have to come into, like, part of the reason why superhero movies are so successful and part of the reason why the Snyder ones are not so as successful is because they thrive on other avenues like toy sales and, other merchandise that goes with it. And kids aren't snatching up, Ben Affleck's Batman on a t-shirt.
I mean, Tim Burton's Batman series was derailed because of McDonald's Happy Meals. Like, McDonald's looked at that movie and went, we can't make freaking Happy Meals out of a penguin that rips off somebody's nose.
But how'd they promote Dark Knight then with toys and stuff like that?
Did they? Well, they didn't. Did they do Dark Knight Happy Meals?
No, they didn't. No.
Yeah.
No.
You can't do give a kid an action figure for Joker. I mean, you just
nine
can't do
times
that.
Out of you ten, know I mean? You know, 9 times out of 10, that's what's driving the decision. On the 10th example, it's Nolan giving you one of the best superhero movies ever created. But for the most part, they're making those decisions. But like, filming Six Underground had no it didn't have a blip on the radar. Like, no one talked about it at all.
Yeah.
You know, I think more people talk about Extraction, the Chris Hemsworth movie. You know, that at least had some legs to it. People discussed it, but I just don't know how to gauge success on these.
That's what I'm trying to understand.
Titles.
Like, Six Underground was, you know, where'd all that money go? Like, I'm just trying to understand, like, and they're spending that much money on a lot of films. Like, you know how much The Crown costs to make? Now,
The Crown, to their defense, they're the Kleenex of streaming services. You know?
What do you mean?
They're Netflix. They're Netflix. Netflix is the example you say when Band-Aid, you're talking about streaming. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that was the business model was, if we become Coca-Cola of streaming's here forever. We will make billions of dollars however many years down the road.
Yeah, so. I mean, and I don't think anybody will ever be like Blockbuster and Netflix like that. They'll always be the leader in that terminology when it comes to streaming.
Or honestly, at this point, you could argue Apple's done the same. Did you ever hear that story that Microsoft got so pissed because they paid millions upon millions upon millions of dollars for to be the supplier for tablets for coaches and defensive coordinators and stuff on sidelines and football games? And the commentators would make comments like, oh, you see the coach over there with his iPad getting this and this and this. And Microsoft is like, what the hell? Like, we're paying millions of dollars to be like your tablet, and your commentators are calling it iPads.
That's funny.
That's what, when you transition into the definitive, like Band-Aid for a long time, I didn't realize that was a name brand. I didn't know that either. Yeah.
Like, I know Jacuzzi is. Like, I know Jacuzzi is a name brand of a hot tub. And people
wait, is Jacuzzi not as a name brand?
Jacuzzi's a brand.
That's funny.
I always call that thing a jacuzzi, or I always call that thing a Band-Aid.
Like, pretty soon, people are going to be like, what are you listening to? And they're going to be like, I'm listening to a real blend. Like, it's just going to be, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between.
That's the podcast. But look at Google. Like, Google is a verb, you know?
Google it. Yeah, the thing is that I don't like, say, let me Google it and go to, like, Ask Jeeves.
AirBuds is almost almost becoming its own thing, too.
Yeah, like, put in your AirPods.
AirPods, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Like, people say AirPods. Like, put your AirPods in. Even though
I call
might
them AirBuds too all the time.
That's a dog that plays basketball.
Remember, what was the sequel? The sequel to that movie had a great title. It was a golden retriever or whatever it was. Like, it was like
golden
it was
receiver.
Golden receiver.
One.
That's what it was.
Golden receiver.
Golden receiver.
We went a direction I did not expect us to go.
Golden
receiver. Yeah,
that was a great title. I thought that was such a brilliant play on that. Because he was like, I remember the poster was like, it was like a football movie, football. Yeah, it was,
oh, they made them. They made one for every sport. Essentially,
golden receiver.
There's a whole slew of those AirPod titles. all right, let's move on to this week in movies. Gabe wants us to rave about a new series coming to Amazon Prime Video by Robert Kirkman, who everyone kind of knows from The Walking Dead, but he has a comic book series called Invincible that is getting an animated adaptation. Gabe, tell us why we should care.
You shouldn't know anything going into it. It's one of those. All I will say is it's superhero related. It's about a kid getting his powers. His dad's essentially Superman in this universe. And it is one of the coolest stories I've ever read. I'm not qualifying that with superhero. It's one of the coolest stories I've ever read. It's one of the most interesting and fresh superhero stories I've ever read. And it was like, I read like the first issue and fell in love with it. The cast is amazing. It's Robert Kirkman, who is, I think, is super creative. So don't miss this one. Check it out.
Okay.
Yes. That's Amazon?
Amazon Prime. Yeah. Prime
yes. And
I saw
who
a few
saw
people doing the junket, but I turned them down after I didn't get invited.
Who saw Nobody?
I did.
Kev, tell us about Nobody.
This is David, you know, David Leitch. So it's he produced it. This is like, you know, essentially in that John Wick Atomic Blonde style of filmmaking. Leitch didn't direct it, but Leitch is a producer on it, and Leitch obviously co-directed first John Wick, and then him and Stelhesky went on. I think Stelhesky went on to do two, and then Leitch did Atomic Blonde. So it's it's very much in that brand. Odenkirk is great in it because he's such an unassuming badass, but a realistic badass, like in the sense of like. What I appreciated about the film is that you actually see him get hurt. And I think that happened with John Wick too, where like they don't make an action scene where he kills or beats up like 10 people. He doesn't walk away feeling like he just had like the greatest workout of his life. He walks away beaten up, bruised, beaten down. That bus scene that's in the trailer, I mean, he takes a big beating in that scene. And like, to me, it just added a sense of realism and grounded element to that's what it would be like to see this guy in this situation. Like, I don't believe he's on some superhero level. He is a human being who has training. And Odenkirk is not, you know, even he'll even say this. He said this in my interview. It's not like, you know, when you look at Keanu Reeves and Charlize Theron, you can see the action star. And he says, like, for me, I don't know if you necessarily see it. But in the sense of, like, he is playing like an ordinary guy who just happens to be in an extraordinary situation that he did have training in the past. He's now has a family, wants to move on. It gets brought back through him, you know, essentially.
Is there a good reason for bringing it back?
Yeah, well, he protects a bystander on the bus, and the people he beats up end up being part of a bigger villain picture, and that kind of lures him back into that. Because basically, someone breaks into his house in the beginning of the film, and that's all tied to the storyline specifically. Okay. Like, and he doesn't like at one point during the break-in, which is in the trailer, he has the opportunity to probably beat the crap out of all the people who broke into his house, but he just decides to restrain himself and not do it because basically you put yourself on the map if you do something hard, like if you do something like that. But even in self-defense, people would question, oh, how did you even do that? What training did you have in the past? So he kind of keeps it hidden, almost like Superman not saving his father's life in Man of Steel. Like he does it to hide his powers.
Does he work at Cinnabon and they shoot it in black and white?
They shoot it in black and white, and you're just waiting for Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul to show up the whole time.
I understand that reference because I watched the show.
Yes,
because
you do
I fulfilled
now.
My end of the bargain.
Is it? It's just theaters, right?
Yes, nobody? Only theaters. Yeah, only theaters. I appreciate the fact that they're only doing it in theaters.
It's but really it's coming to PVOD in a few weeks, right?
I think. Well, isn't that Universal's deal? Yep. It's like 17 days.
Oh, they have 17 days.
Yeah, which is another great way to look at the shorter windows and you know, again, give the theatrical the initial run. I keep lowering my days here from 45 to 30 to 17, but as long as you get that theatrical run initially, I don't care how long it takes. As long, just give it a week or two. 17 days is perfect, actually.
All right, this week's blend game. We chose the films of Antoine Fuqua, and try as I might, I could not come up with anything besides Training Day. So I went Training Day, and
we all agreed we weren't doing Training Day.
Oh, did we say
you
that?
You could pick Training Day, but you had to have a second to at least discuss so we could diversify our...
Okay.
So what would be your number two? We can still discuss Training Day because we don't need to gloss over a great film. But
I think Training Day across the board. I think we probably even did this when we did Denzel somewhat recently.
Yes,
because we talked because you guys
at least
a couple
two
of you picked,
did. I think at least two of you did.
Picked Training Day, and it's just it's hard with Antoine Fuqua because I feel like in a way we talked about this with Tarantino. You know, when you come out the gate with something early in your career that's as good as that is, you're always going to be sort of competing with that or chasing it to a certain degree. And I'm not quite sure that he is going to ever make a film that's just that good. Everything clicked for that film in particular. If I had to go to another one, I'd go to The Equalizer. And I liked The Equalizer a lot more than I thought I was going to. You know, remake of an old television show, just had a pretty good concept. But I love the fact that Antoine Fuqua has just found sort of his muse in Denzel. And he brings out the weight that Denzel can bring to a role. The drama and the life lived, Denzel can do that so well. And I will also hold on to Equalizer because it's one of my most favorite junket experiences when I got to interview Denzel and Antoine Fuqua together. And I asked the right question to start off the day, which was just that movie takes place in the finale of it takes place in a Home Depot type warehouse. And Denzel's character sets off the fire alarms, so it's raining down on them the whole time, which is a great stylistic choice. And I said, but Denzel, that must have been pretty awful to film. And he told this amazing story about just like how much he hated Antoine Fuqua. Like on the first day it made sense, but after 18 hours of filming it and then having to film it for multiple days, and he just did it in like the greatest Denzel, and Antoine Fuqua was dying laughing, and it was it'll always go down as one of my favorite sort of junket memories because I just knew I'd asked something that people weren't asking, and it triggered some really great stories. So selfishly, for that reason, I'm going to pick Equalizer for.
There are some people. I feel like junket people always say that like the laughter bar that you want to get as an interviewer is Julia Roberts, and she obviously has a great laugh. One. She has a famous laugh. But I'm with you, Sean, and that like I think there's nothing better than because when you interview Denzel, if you can get a Denzel laugh, like it's zero or ten. When that dude laughs, he laughs big, and you know it, and everyone in the hallway knows it. Like, it's such a great moment. And honestly, like, coming from him, it's such a great feeling. And, no, I'm with, like, oh, there's nothing better in an interview than a Denzel. I to me, my, like, laughter bar is a Denzel Washington laugh.
That's a good one. All right, what's your choice, then, for Antoine?
Well, aside from Training Day, because I agree with you in that, like, Training Day is also... People don't appreciate how meticulously crafted that movie is. Like, there are lines that are said in the distance by characters that have implications. You know, there's one moment where, like, the focus is on Jake, is on Ethan Hawke, and Alonzo is in the background, casually on the phone, and you hear him very softly say to someone on the phone, get the bathtub ready. And then, obviously, you end up seeing... Jake in the bathtub with a shotgun in his face screaming, I have a little girl. So like just the ridiculous, like him grabbing the Chinese food menu in the opening scene off of his car windshield and then using it as the warrant later on. There's so many little moments that are just beautiful. Anton Fuqua, the year before Training Day, maybe the 2 years before, did a movie with Jamie Foxx and David Morse called Bait. And I love that movie. It is basically a pristine thief steals like millions of dollars worth of gold. And there is a reason that they think that Jamie Foxx bumped into this guy and that somehow Jamie Foxx might inadvertently know where the gold is. So David Morse runs this kind of CIA spying operative. And this was at a time where like the idea of like there being cameras on every corner was still kind of a new, oh my God, are they watching us kind of idea. And so it's all a, basically they start using Jamie Foxx and putting him without him knowing it into dangerous, precarious positions to attract this gold thief by making him believe that Jamie Foxx knows where the gold is or has the gold. It's a really fun movie. It's still when it was before Jamie Foxx really kind of started venturing into drama, so he was still really fun, comedic Jamie Foxx. He's got some... I think David Morse is a truly underrated actor, and he's got some really fun moments with David Morse. It has a surprisingly great score, like a weirdly great score. I remember like even thinking like the score for this movie is so much better than it has any right to be. It's a really fun movie. 21 years later, it's probably a little dated because the entire focus is technology that we kind of all assume is now part of our reality now, but at the time was very much kind of on the cusp of like, wait, is this actually a thing? But if you've never seen the movie Bait, I think it might be Antoine Fuqua's like directorial, like feature directorial debut. It's really a great movie. I was leaning toward Olympus Has Fallen for a second, but I eventually had to go with Bait just because it's so much fun, and I remember loving it as a kid, and I rewatched it a few years ago. And aside from like the idea of the technology being a little dated, it's still very fun.
Very cool. I never even heard of it. Kev, what did you pick?
I went with Olympus Has Fallen, and I rewatched that recently, which it's awesome. I know it's Die Hard in the White House, but it's so much fun. It's extremely well done from an action perspective, and I thought that Gerard Butler was great. You know, it's a pretty terrifying film if you think about it. It's very, very violent. That whole sequence in the bunker with Aaron Eckhart and Melissa Leo as they're trying to get the numbers out of them for the codes for whatever the nuclear launch would be. Just a really, like, I thought at the end of the day, that movie is like a very over-the-top explosive action film that actually has grounded realism to the consequences of what would happen if that actually went down. And, one of the things I always find fascinating about movies like that is they're like, do you ever wonder when you watch those, like, wait, are they giving people ideas on how to do these things? Like they're like, it's so specifically planned out and like exacting and like, here's how they're doing it. And I'm like, and I guess what they have to do, I would love to ask Antoine Fuqua this. When you do a movie like that, and you're basically breaking in and taking over the White House, do you have to clear it with like security?
Oh, that's interesting.
That's a little too That's a little too realistic, you know, or whatever it is. Like, is this going to give somebody the wrong idea? And I always, like, every time I watch the Olympus Has Fallen, I'm like, it just seems as if, like, they found, like, the movie finds a way to make you believe
like Ocean's
11.
Like, Ocean's 11 makes, it makes it feel like we could all go rob a casino in Vegas.
Right. And so, like, I would have to imagine that before putting out something like that, there's, because I mean, you're dealing with the whole Camp David. Doesn't he go to Camp David in the beginning? And there's like it's all like, you know, because that's how the wife dies off of the bridge in the snowy limo scene. And like, and it's just like, it just seems they built in so much of what we know and about our world that it always, those types of movies always fascinate me. You know, I'm always like, wait, is somebody going to like learn how to do something bad by watching these movies?
We saw that movie together, you and I, in New York.
Yeah, we did. Olympus Has Fallen is, I think, an underrated action film. London Has Fallen was terrible.
I would say that was the summer that two White House Invasion movies were coming out, and the other one was Roland Emmerich, and I don't know about you, I kind of assumed the other one was going to be better, and ended up Olympus of, like White House Down sucked, and Olympus Has Fallen was awesome. That was a great pick,
and it's rated R. It's brutal. It's like it's unapologetically an R-rated action film. Like, it's just genuinely awesome. Like, I think if people revisit it, some of the CGI doesn't hold up as well, especially when they're flying. Some of the characters are flying over the monument, and you see the monument topple. But like, some of that CGI is a little dated. But overall, I thought it's a really, really well paced and just intriguing action scene movie. And I also think Gerard Butler's great in the movie. I actually think he gives a great performance. I think his dedication to the president is believable, and it's just an awesome film.
I wanted to go back. That's a great pick. I wanted to go back to Jake's pick, though, because you mentioned the music. I love Bait. I grew up watching Bait.
Yes!
And you mentioned the music, and I was like, who did that? It was Mark Mancina, who, if you don't know, he was the composer for Speed, for Bad Boys.
Oh, which also has a great... Oh, great
for Twister, for Con Air, for Speed 2, for Bait, for Training Day, for... There was a couple other ones. He did August Rush, Shooter, which is a Fuqua, another great Fuqua movie. And then he did the original score composed by, is the official credit on Moana.
Wait, was August Rush the Joseph Gordon-Levitt bicycle movie?
No, you're thinking Premium Rush.
No, August Rush was the kid with the guitar.
Yeah, the kid that plays guitar is August
Premium
Rush.
Premium Rush, I forgot about that.
Not to be confused with Rush.
He and Michael Shannon were opposing bicycle messenger guys or some such.
Anyway, what a great resume.
I want to seek that out. All right, audience picks for Antoine Fuqua. Michelle Garris said The Magnificent Seven. I know it's a remake of a remake of a remake, but it's so much fun to watch. Gregory Voigt also picked Magnificent Seven. Michael Breen, Josh Kemig, and many, many others went Training Day. Ross Cordnell said Southpaw. And there was also some love for
Southpaw
his version of
great, by the
King
way, with Jake
Arthur.
Gyllenhaal. That was great.
And Rachel McAdams. Always gets points from Rachel McAdams. For next week's Blend game, we would be playing hashtag. I can't believe we haven't done this one before. Feels like we've done this one. No? Hashtag Kate Winslet Blend. We played Kate Winslet Blend? No, we haven't, because that's weird to say. Kate Winslet Blend.
Gabe is the real blend historian. He's got a pretty good idea about what we have and have not done.
All right. Well, we're diving into the work of Kate Winslet.
Historian or guy with a spreadsheet? You know, it's.
Let us know your picks.
Historians
via email.
Have spreadsheets.
RealBlend@cinemablend.com, or you can use social media hashtag KateWinsletBlend. At that website, you can also send us reviews. We do not have a review this week, but make sure you head over to Apple Podcast, drop us a fun review, and we will read it on the show. Well, we're not doing good enough, apparently, Jake. Not enough to inspire the masses. We got to step up our game.
My shoulders hurt from carrying the show all week.
On our next premium episode, it's a mailbag episode.
Hey, mailbag! Do we have questions?
It's always very fun. You can access premium episodes by doing a $5 a month subscription. And you can go to premium to access that at bit.ly/realblendpremium. And in the meantime, follow us on social media. We'll be back next week with a full-on show. Some pretty exciting guests on the radar in the hopper. Hashtag if it happens. Follow us at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Go check out the Zack Snyder interview if you guys missed it. And hopefully you guys enjoyed this week's interview with Adam Wingard. And until next week.
We forgot to ask Zach if Snyder if he watched Hubie.
No, but we did ask him if he watched Tenet, and everyone was like, "Can't believe you guys asked him if he watched Tenet." I was like, "Well, Nolan's his producer. Like, that, we didn't just pull it out of left. We're not just asking people if they watched
Tenet." That would be like someone asking me if I've read your book. Like, that's a legitimate question.
Oh, dude, you made me laugh so hard with that joke on social media that I just text you a link to buy my book. Because there's some truth to that. Like, I feel like that's something I would do. Because I'm a whore, like we've said.
Kimmy!
Like you told Zack Snyder.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.